Bob Lederer joins us on Sports Byline. He's been a Jets fan since the team's inception in 1963. He's followed the team through its many ups and downs, its evolution into a championship-contending team. And he says the Jets' victory on January the 12th, 1969, when he was just a boy, and the Jets won Super Bowl III against the Baltimore Colts, was the most exciting day in his life. And he writes about the ecstasy and agony of being a Jets fan in his book, Beyond Broadway Joe, the Super Bowl that changed football. First of all, Bob, what was your motivation for writing this book?
Well, I'm going to correct one thing you just said. It was the most exciting sports day in my life because my wife might listen to this. And if she does, I don't want to get in trouble. Well, my motivation for the book actually goes back to 1963. I became a Jet fan one night in October of 1963 when I turned on the local radio station in New York. And I heard Bob Murphy, who was the announcer for the New York Mets at that time. I'd just become a Mets fan that year. And I went, whoa, Bob Murphy is doing football. And I knew nothing about football. But that night, I became an interested party in the New York Jets. And I started reading everything I could in all of the New York newspapers. And in those days, there were many, many of them. And read all the football magazines at the beginning of each pro football season. And watched the Jets sign players. And obviously, the team started to grow. It evolved from a joke, even in the American Football League, as the New York Jets. Everybody seems to know they had started in the AFL under a different name, the New York Titans, and under different ownership. But they evolved between 1963 and 1969 into the team that eventually did win the Super Bowl. And one thing really caught my attention, Ron, in 1963. I already, into the season, you know, wasn't that aware of this, but I read up that Weeb Eubank, the coach and general manager that had been brought in by principal owner Sonny Werblin, had said that he had a five-year plan to turn this moribund franchise into a championship contender. And I read even further that Weeb had said and done the same thing in Baltimore with the Colts 11 years earlier. And he had done it there in 6 years. So I watched very carefully what he was doing, who he was bringing in, the positions he was filling. And it, when 1969 and the Super Bowl game came around, and I was as shocked as anybody that the Jets won, that's what made it the day that will always, you know, live in my memory sports-wise, because there was wholly no anticipation from 95%, maybe even more, of the American public that was paying attention to the game that day that the Jets would win. And over the years, because I'm a writer by profession, I had said to myself, you know, you really ought to write a book about that team. And I would think about it for a moment and go on and go do something else. And the motivation finally reached its peak about 3 years ago. I live in Skokie, Illinois now, and I was watching a replay of Super Bowl III on the NFL Network. And I was watching it with my two teenage sons. And my wife walked in and said, when are you ever going to write a book about that team? You keep telling us about how much you love them and how you want to write a book about them. And I looked at her and said, I can't write another book about Joe Namath. It's been done over and over again. There's no need for a book like that. I don't have an angle. And within a half an hour, one son had asked me about the left defensive end on the New York Jets, number 81, Jerry Philbin, and I told him, well, he happened to be one of my favorite players when I was a Jet fan back in the 60s. And then my other son said, boy, that 75 at left tackle, Winston Hill, he's just dominating that side of the field. And I said, well, that's Winston Hill, and he was an All-Pro and an AFL All-Star more times than I can even remember. And at that point, I turned to my wife and I said, I just got the angle on the book. I'm going to do a book about everybody else on that team.
Yeah, the 39 Forgotten is what they're called, and I'll get to them in just a second. But what I've always found interesting about the Jets at that period of time and the Super Bowl championship team is the marriage between Joe Namath and Weeb Eubank. You talk about direct opposites. That's what they were. Why did that marriage work?
Because Weeb had an open mind. as traditional as Weeb Eubank was, as crew cut as Weeb Eubank absolutely insisted on being, he was also a realist. And he looked at what was going on in the 60s with long hair and eventually with beards and sideburns and mustaches and everything, you know, amongst his football players. And he didn't really think that that was important as long as they played on the field, you know, to the best of their ability. And in fact, I can tell you a story. The year after the Super Bowl, Steve Thompson, who had been a defensive backup the year before and who now is in line to be a starter, came to camp with a beard and a mustache and long, shaggy hair. And Weeb said, "I don't like your hair, but just play good football."
That certainly speaks volumes for Weeb, because he certainly was like that. You know, one of the guys on the team, and you talk about it, it's a great story, is Curley Johnson. He was kind of the team prankster. And when Joe got there, he pulled a prank on him. Tell everybody about that.
It was the first training camp for Mr. Namath in with the Jets in 1965. In Peekskill, New York, they trained at the Peekskill Academy in those days, because that's where Sonny Werblin's boys were going to school. And Curley, who was the prankster, and I didn't know this going into writing this book, and the last time that Curley Johnson ever spoke to somebody was to me, and he confirmed the story. And the story was that Curley got on the phone, put on a falsetto voice, called Joe in his room, and basically picked him up and said, "Hey, if you meet me outside, you know, or down here at whatever an hour from now, we can have a really good time." Well, Joe wasn't going to miss the opportunity. Of course, Curley Johnson let half the team know that what was going to happen, and they were all standing on the other side of the wall. When Joe was standing there waiting for his date to come in, Curley walked in and said, "Hi, darling."
You know as well as I do that when you have a personality as big as Joe Namath's personality was, and especially in a market like New York, that sometimes the chemistry does not develop between the players and the star player. Why did it develop so well in New York?
I think because his talent was so obvious. Larry Grantham, who is one of the greatest linebackers in Jet history and who was on, you know, the team, the Titans, from 1960 through 1972 with the Jets, told me that there was a lot of concern about all the money that Joe got, $427,000 for a three-year contract. But when Joe came to training camp and got out on the field, and the players all knew that he had a bum knee that he had just had operated on. He took the ball, and he started whizzing it in all directions all over the field. And jaws dropped, and Grantham said nobody cared what Joe was getting paid after that. And as a matter of fact, Joe getting that kind of money actually ended up working for the veteran players, because the guys that we really cared about, including Grantham, all got raises.
You know, you talk in this book about Weeb Eubank and the fact that he developed a system that would evaluate his players on every particular play. And as I looked at that, I found it really fascinating, because I don't remember anybody else in pro football doing that at that time. Tell me a little more about what he did.
Well, it all came to pass at Washington University in St. Louis, which I believe was Weeb's first head coaching job. And by the way, Charlie Winter, who was a student there at the time, played for Weeb there. And what he basically did was develop a system where, and this is what happened with the Jets, I'm not sure exactly what its earliest incarnations looked like, but he rated each play for each player from zero, meaning you did nothing on that play, to five, which was tantamount to you made a play that might happen once a year. And so defensively, it's an easier thing for me to explain. That would be, for instance, a linebacker causing a fumble, picking up the fumble, and running it in for a touchdown. A four would be causing the fumble and covering it. So he had this intricate system. Now think about this in the 1960s and even before, but particularly in the 60s when he really went a whole hog on this. They had only two offensive coaches and two defensive coaches. And everything, all the ratings were done on film. And so, for instance, Walt Michaels and Buddy Ryan, who were the Jets' two defensive coaches during the Super Bowl team year, would be sitting down in the dark. They would run a play. And then they would run a play over and over again, and they'd grade the left tackle, then the left guard, then the center, then the right guard, then the right tackle, and then, of course, the quarterback, each of the running backs, the wide receivers, the tight end. So imagine how many times they had to do that, and they had to do that for every single play of every single game. And then you would get a grade each week and a final grade at the end of the year. And if you graded 90 or better, you got your bonus. Everything done by hand. You know, my father would have been proud because he always taught me to do everything in my head.
You point out in the book how Super Bowl III may have saved the existence of several AFL teams scheduled to be part of that AFL-NFL merger. How so?
Jerry Philbin told me, and a couple of the other guys said they heard the same thing. Bob Calamini was another one, that in the recesses of the locker room during the practice sessions in the 2 weeks before the game, there were murmurs about the fact that the National Football League was looking to find ways to make the merger work for them. The merger had been announced in 1966, but it wouldn't take effect until 1970 because there were TV contracts still in effect. And Jerry told me that what he heard was that they were going to potentially drop some of the really financially weak American Football League teams. And specifically, the weakest teams in 1968-69, think about this, were the Boston Patriots and the Denver Broncos. So think about how football, the National Football League's history might have changed if there was no Boston Patriots franchise. In fact, I kidded somebody the other day and said, oh, what the heck, Tom Brady might have become a Jet.
We only have 2 minutes left. Tell people what you'd like to have them take out of this book.
This book, I think, is a wonderful and first-time historical look at the entire New York Jets team. Namath has always gotten the credit, and he has well-deserved every bit of the credit he's received. But Joe, even in his own time with his own teammates, has always said, in fact, he did right after the Super Bowl game, asked if he was the king of the hill. He said, nope, we're the kings of the hill. We've got the team. So he's always played a great deal of respect and really thrown out bouquets, you know, to all the guys who played around him. But we live in a 15-second soundbite era where Joe and anybody else doesn't really have the time to tell you how good a player Winston Hill and Larry Grantham and John Elliott and Jerry Philbin and Emerson Boozer and Matt Snell and Don Maynard and George Sauer and more of those players were. In fact, the 1968-69 New York Jets, the World Championship team, sent 11 players to the American Football League All-Star Game.
We only have a minute left, but is there a particular memory about the Jets that you have that's ingrained in your mind forever, Bob?
Wow, one play. You know, I don't. But I've seen the Super Bowl game now about 10 times from all kinds of different angles. I actually found 3 different views of that Super Bowl game. And so I've seen plays that I've been able to put into slow motion and watch myself. In fact, yes, there is one play that I remember distinctly, and I'll do it real quickly. John Elliott was the right tackle for the Jets. And in the Super Bowl, there was one play early in the first quarter where the Colts snapped the ball. They were going to run up the middle against Elliott. The right guard on the Baltimore Colts attacked Elliott and tried to knock him off stride. Elliott kind of just threw him to the side. Then the left guard hit Elliott and tried to knock him off stride, and Elliott basically just kind of leaned away, and then the guard went running right by him. Here came the fullback, Jerry Hill, and Elliott just picked him up and threw him aside. And finally, Tom Matte came through the hole, and Elliott put him in a bear hug and stopped him after a one-yard gain. That, to me, was about as fabulous a one-person effort as I think could ever be seen in any professional football game.
Well, thank you, Bob Lederer. I appreciate it. This is an outstanding book. We recommend it to everybody. Thanks for being with us. Take care and come back and visit with us again.
I'd love to, and please invite me back.
Bob Lederer with us. He is the author of this book. He's been a Jets fan almost all of his life. I guess you could say all of his life. It's called Beyond Broadway Joe. We continue on Sports Byline.